Terrestrial man will never gain a working knowledge of universal law, or of his creator, so long as he permits other men to do his thinking, accepting on faith alone interpretations of universal wisdom handed down through the centuries, along with errors in translations and personal selections of what was thought right for the people to know. He does not have to give up anything or alter religious beliefs to gain knowledge of the universe. All a man has to do is think for himself. He must merge his thinking with the whole creation instead of confining his thoughts to himself, or permitting others to censor his thoughts. Each must do his own work of rebuilding. As Emerson put it, gift is contrary to the law of the universe. Serving others is serving. Understanding this, it is obvious why the interplanetary visitors do not want any cult or religion established in their name. Those organizing sects, or making a religion of the space people and their visitations, have been and are working right in line with the factions who would keep mankind in ignorance for the promotion of their own special benefits. Some leaders are innocently working in this respect. Others are working for self-aggrandizement. Some, I am sure, are being paid by the silence group whose greatest asset is keeping people from thinking for themselves, and thus in ignorance. Whatever the purpose, all are spreading confusion in the path of sincere seekers. At the same time, ridicule is heaped upon the entire program by the man who dares to think for himself. He refuses to believe all that he is told by others until something reasonable enters the picture. Then he is able to build a conviction with a firm foundation. Our interplanetary friends, who are as normal and human as you and I, could not allow such falseness, with its resultant confusion, to be built up and continued in regard to them and their visitations to Earth. They told me that it was most important that I should clear up the matter in the minds of Earthlings. It was to this end that the world tour was arranged. It is only in retrospect that I realize the foundation for such a program was started several years before. It was set up from the very beginning by correspondence resulting from the publication of Inside the Spaceships in 1955, when certain individuals in nations throughout the world were enough impressed by the book to write to me. Book 2, 1. America to New Zealand, in late 1956, my colleagues and I were spending a few months in Chapala, Jalisco, Mexico. Mail from all over the world continued to increase in volume. I realized that, after our vacation was over and we returned to the United States, something would have to be done to ease the workload on my secretary. It was on this vacation that I shot the 16mm color motion pictures of the huge domed spacecraft that hovered near the highway. We returned to Palomar Terraces in early 1957. My secretary could not possibly cope with the increasing interest in the spacecraft. My first book, co-authored with Desmond Leslie, and originally published in England, Canada, and the United States in 1953, had by this time been translated and published in at least a dozen other languages. I had not been the first to alert people to the strange objects flying in the sky. Kenneth Arnold had reported unexplainable objects in 1947. Frank Scully, in his book Behind the Flying Saucers 5, related the story of an unidentified craft that had crash-landed in New Mexico. The incident recorded in Flying Saucers Have Landed was the first account published in modern times of a personal meeting with a human being from another planet. 5. Henry Holienko, New York. Desmond Leslie, a British subject of Irish ancestry, became interested in ancient accounts of strange aerial objects. As a result, he spent several years perusing old manuscripts and compiling data. His book was in the hands of a publisher in London when my personal meeting with a man from Venus was publicized in a Western USA newspaper. This was world news and it soon reached England. Both the publisher and Desmond Leslie wrote to me for details of my contact. I had received so many letters of inquiry about my experience that I had my account of it put into manuscript form, with the intention of having it published in small booklets to send in answer to these letters. I sent this manuscript to Leslie's publisher. It was suggested that my experiences be added to his book to bring the account up to date. This was a great opportunity to fulfill the space people's request for me to present my information to the people. After the book was published, I received a humorous letter from Leslie which said, "I don't know what has happened, George. But all the mediums have suddenly disposed of their Indian guides, etc., and have replaced them with space people traveling in Vimanas." This was all too true. This trend toward mysticism was the beginning of the perversion of the real purpose for which the space people came to Earth. This distortion of truth has been perpetuated by opportunists and has caused worldwide confusion. This same distortion has hampered a scientific approach to the wonders of the universe. As I have stated before, the psychic groups have become excellent tools in the hands of the silence group. Hearing these conditions in mind, we realize that each sincere question should have a sincere answer. But how were we to accomplish such a great task? In the course of one of my contacts, I mentioned to the brothers the problems I was having. They advised an excellent solution. Briefly, it was this: I would write correspondents from each country and ask them if they would be willing to receive all the mail from their own countries. In turn, they would receive a periodic letter from me which they could reproduce and pass on to all interested persons. This was called our Get Acquainted program. The co-workers' letters contained all the latest information from many countries, and the program worked splendidly to keep people informed. Cooperation was excellent and the program relieved much of the workload on my secretary and myself. In 1958 I received a letter from Australia, saying that a group of people there would finance a trip to their country if I would consent to lecture for them. When groups in other countries heard of the Australian offer, they asked for a similar program. The secretary of one group in Australia, Gordon L. Jameson, wrote from Brisbane and explained that it would be impossible for me to take any money out of their country. All expenses such as plane fare, room and board, etc., would have to be taken care of by the respective groups. This proved to be true of all nations. I was advised that it was of great importance that I accept this opportunity in order that the people of the world might be informed of the true purpose of the visitations from our space friends. It was agreed that I would start the tour in January, 1959. Accordingly, on January 13 I left Los Angeles International Airport on the first leg of my world tour. Arrangements had been made for a two-day visit in Hawaii to break the long flight to New Zealand. This was a welcome event, for several correspondents and friends live in Hawaii and I wanted to meet them. When the plane arrived, my friends were there to meet me. In their customary aloha greeting, I was bedecked with aloha, so many, in fact, that I could barely see over the top of them. It was quite late that evening when my friends bade me good night. We had had an enjoyable visit and no one had noticed the clock. Before leaving, a request was made and granted to arrange an informal dinner party for the following evening where I could speak and answer questions of interested guests. It was thought that only a small group of 35 or so would attend. As it turned out, this number was more than doubled. Following a most enjoyable dinner, I gave a short lecture, after which the guests asked many questions. I was amazed by the eager response from people hungry for down-to-earth information about the spacecraft and their occupants. This held true throughout my entire tour, in every country which I had the pleasure of visiting. During my two-day stay in Hawaii, I was taken by my kind hosts on a tour of the main island, Oahu. I took motion pictures up through Niuanupali, a pass through Daikoura mountain range. This scenic route connects the eastern shore to the windward or western side of the island. From an observation point I could see the Bayview Memorial Park where victims of the Pearl Harbor attack are buried. One of the unusual sights I noticed was the monkey pod tree. The wood from these trees cannot be used for construction purposes, but, because of its unusual graining, it is widely used in making dishes, novelties and souvenirs. On the way back from one day's lovely trip we passed through Tanulas, a scenic drive through heavily wooded areas and beautiful homes. Night blooming cirrus covered the banks along the road. The view of Honolulu Harbor was an inspiring sight from the high points. The oriental architecture of the homes of wealthy Chinese and Japanese businessmen was very beautiful, seen through the magnificent trees and shrubbery lining the boulevards we traveled. All too quickly time passed for me and I had to resume my trip. At the airport, Before I boarded my plane for New Zealand, my friends extended hearty invitations for me to return to Hawaii when I could spend more time on the islands. My short time there was so enjoyable that someday I'd like to return for an extended vacation. Shortly after I boarded the plane in Honolulu, we were on our way to the next stop, the Fiji Islands. Here I had to change planes for one going to New Zealand. The one out of Honolulu was going straight to Australia. Upon arriving at Fiji, I found my plane was not scheduled to leave for over an hour, although it was standing on the runway. The outside temperature at this airport was 110 degrees. It didn't take long before we all looked like wet sponges, although the native workers didn't seem to notice the intense heat. The Qantas Airlines did their best for our comfort by providing cold drinks of all kinds to help quench our thirst. We had no way of knowing how long the plane bound for New Zealand had been standing in the hot sun, but when the time arrived for us to go aboard, the heat inside was stifling. This did not last for long, however, for when we were airborne the plane cooled off so rapidly that we seemed to be freezing, and I had to put on my top coat. On Saturday, January 17, we reached New Zealand and landed at Wenuapai Airport in Auckland. Henk, Sick, and Brenda Hinfler and UFO study group leaders from North Island were at the airport awaiting my arrival. After clearing customs and freshening up a bit, we all had dinner and soon became good friends. These men and women had come to Auckland from all parts of North Island to meet me and plan my lecture schedules. The following Monday I was given a reception sponsored by the Auckland Group. While in Auckland, I was called for a half-hour program on the local television station, at that time the only TV station in New Zealand. It was an interesting experience, as their equipment and methods of broadcasting differed greatly from those found in the United States. The only problem I encountered in New Zealand was the tight schedule outlined for my tour. I had to request that one of the lectures be cancelled so that I could conserve my health and cover the remaining tour. On January 20, the first lecture took place in Kaiko, a two-hour flight from Auckland. A small bus took us into town from Kaiko's nearest airport, a distance or some 20 miles through rugged mountain terrain. Some of the passengers became ill from the wild ride and the driver had to stop for them. Later we could see the humorous side of the experience and decided that our driver should have been a flying saucer pilot. That evening, a group meeting was held for the Kaiko Saucer Club with the public lecture scheduled for the following evening. The club had reserved the largest hall available, nevertheless a lot of people were turned away for lack of seats. Henk, who made this trip with me, and I had to be back in Auckland the next day, January 22, for a lecture in the town hall. Early in the morning on the 22nd, we gathered our belongings and left for the airport. In Auckland the town hall seated 2,000 people, and the tickets had all been sold days in advance. Several hundred people were standing outside when we arrived at the hall. Inside, people were sitting in the stage wings and on the platform. For those who were unable to get inside, loudspeakers were connected to the public address system and placed outside so that they could at least hear what was being said. The next morning I was called for an interview by the leading radio station of Auckland. All the radio stations in New Zealand are controlled by the government, other than that they are much the same as found in the United States. The television producers, radio stations and newspapers were all very considerate and helpful in New Zealand. A tape recording was made, which the government sent ahead of me to be played by radio the day before my arrival in each city. I did not encounter this courtesy outside of New Zealand. It seems that the New Zealand government has a policy of cooperation in the fields of learning, much more than other nations, at least much more than the other nations I have visited. As a comparatively new cultural center, New Zealand seems to have a broad outlook toward the future and embraces all fields of endeavor. I had entered the country on a visitor's visa, and it was necessary to obtain a written permit before I could lecture and show my films of spacecraft. The officials made out my permit for 12 months, an indication that the government in that dominion desires to have the truth presented to its people. There were many requests for private lectures, which, unfortunately, I had to refuse. All but one scheduled lecture was completed during my 6 weeks in New Zealand. I received an invitation asking me to visit the Maori King in the Royal Mahinarani House at Ngaruawaia. It turned out to be one of the most interesting experiences of my life. The Maoris are a very intelligent and clever people. They have developed great artistic abilities and their buildings are covered with many varieties of designs, both symbolic and decorative. Some of the people in our party were not known to the Maoris. According to their customs, this prevented us seeing the king, but he sent word through one of his chieftains that I was accepted by the Maoris and would be welcome at any time. The official hostess, Sister Heaney, took us into the reception room or King's Audience Room as it is called. The room was very large and beautifully ornate. The wall-to-wall wool rug, with an all-over Maori design, was hand-woven. The cross beams in the ceiling were hand-carved and coloured and the rafters were painted with Maori symbols. The supporting pillars were covered with hand-woven matting of fine reeds, beautifully designed and coloured. Large lounge chairs encircled the room. As we went outside I noticed a great deal of Maori carving on all the other buildings. Along the front of the eaves and gateways are intricate red carvings depicting the figures that are displayed along the tops of pillars near the entrance. I was given permission to take pictures of the outsides of the buildings and the surrounding grounds. While I was taking pictures of the entranceway, 6 white streaks of light flashed overhead. This caused much interest among the Maoris, as they were not vapor trails, and Sister Heaney said it was a good omen and very significant. As we drove back to Hamilton, the spacecraft streaking through the sky seemed to follow us. This had happened on other occasions and I knew the brothers felt that this was the time and place to make their presence known. Sometime later a Maori lady called on me, and we talked of many things relating to the space people. She mentioned that several of the Maori boys had been taken up for rides in spacecraft. In my next lecture I repeated her story. On February 9, 1959, the New Zealand Herald printed a story to the effect that I had confused fact with a Maori legend concerning Rona, the Maori woman in the moon. They were sure the story I had related about the Maori boys taking a ride was actually a repetition of the ancient Maori legend. This, of course, was not the case, but it does go to show how a speaker's words can be distorted. The following Monday I was taken on a picnic and excursion to the Maori village of Wakarawaewa. Here in the thermal regions, hot water, the Pohutu geyser, and bubbling mud come shooting up through the ground. Many of the hot water pools are of different temperatures, some used for cooking, some for bathing and some for washing clothes. The warm water is so close to the surface that graves cannot be dug, and all bodies are placed in crypts above the ground. The tremendous heat and steam are harnessed by the geothermal power project of Wairoka and are used to heat many nearby communities. Natural steam roaring forth from wells drilled deep into the ground is an awesome sight. I took many feet of film in full color at the tremendous natural activity taking place in this area. Time has a way of running out, and soon I had to leave this scenic wonderland and depart for my next lecture at Napier. Shortly after reaching Napier, I was called by a newspaper man in regard to flying saucer sightings reported in a local newspaper. Although I had a good idea of what had been seen, I told him I would have to meet the people who reported seeing the spacecraft before I made any comment. After talking to the reporter I picked up the local paper and read the article, Flying Saucers Reported Over Lake Taupo, PA, Rotorua. 3 Rotorua people say they watched not one, but dozens of flying saucers operating high above the township of Taupo in bright sunlight on Tuesday. The trio had just farewelled Mr. George Adamski, who claims to have contact with extraterrestrial visitors, who was on his way to Napier. Mr. W. Miller, the local leader of the George Adamski group, said that with his wife and Mr. N. West, he was sitting on the bank overlooking the lake at the end of Taupo's main street, at 3 p.m. asked when they had seen the first flying saucer. The Millers, who have been interested in flying saucers for 2 years, said, "Yesterday. We couldn't say how many there were, but we could have seen the same ones twice," said Mr. Miller. Lying on their backs, they could not pick out vertical movement, nor estimate the height or size of the craft. In addition to these reported sightings, it is rumored in Rotorua that many people, including more than 100 Maoris, saw two spacecraft flying in formation between Garuawea and Hamilton last Sunday. The spacecraft sightings seemed always to come at the right time to awaken public interest. This was one of the reasons we enjoyed overflow crowds at all the New Zealand lectures. My lecture in Napier was scheduled for Wednesday, January 28. I spent the few leisure hours before the lecture viewing the beautiful Napier scenery. I strolled down a long park called the Marine Parade that extends through the city. One of the lovely features of the park was a magnificent bronze statue of the Maori Maiden of the Sea, Painia of the Reef. Most of the places in New Zealand are named after Maori legendary figures, and mythological figures are depicted prominently in their buildings and statues. According to legend, Painia fell in love with a Maori warrior and deserted the sea to live with him on land. Painia's people constantly pleaded with her to return home to the sea and forsake her love. She finally listened to her people and returned to her former home. A shoal or reef lying a few miles offshore has been named in her honor. The bronze statue of Painia is a beautiful portrait of feminine grace. She is seated on a rock with her right leg under the left. Her body is bare to the waist. A Maori flax skirt is artistically draped over her knees. Another attraction in this beautiful park is the huge floral clock constructed by the citizens of Napier. Its face and numerals are of growing flowers in a variety of colors. I saw a number of similar clocks during my trip. All are very large and keep accurate time. Next, I toured the kiwi game farm in Napier. The kiwi is the national bird of New Zealand. Nocturnal in its habits, this bird cannot fly, is about the size of a hen, and has a body covered with hair-like feathers. It has a long, curved beak and finds its food mostly by scent. I was allowed to enter the kiwi enclosure and took a few motion pictures. This was hard to do, as the kiwi always seeks dark corners, and was accomplished only through the kindness of the keeper, who took one of the birds out into the light. In its peculiar gait, it immediately returned to the darkness of its covered shed. My public lecture in Napier was a huge success with standing room only in the large hall where it was held. Later, a second lecture was given at the War Memorial in Napier Marine Gardens. This was to a group of some 100 researchers, and was also very successful. My next lecture was scheduled for Sunday, February 1, in Wellington, the capital of New Zealand. The lecture here was given in the Concert Chamber of Town Hall. This location lent prestige to the lecture. Thus, people who ordinarily would not have attended a flying saucer lecture in a less popular place found little hesitation in attending a town hall. After the lecture in Wellington, I returned to Auckland and made plans for my next public lecture, scheduled for Whanganui. From Whanganui, I journeyed to New Plymouth for a lecture on February 5. The reception in New Plymouth was excellent. While I was waiting in my hotel lobby for a reporter, a French actress came over and wanted to know how I drew such large crowds to the lectures. I told her the interest lay not in me but in the subject I was presenting. It is an established fact that a scientific approach to a controversial topic will draw more people. Intelligent people realize that the spacemen are in no way related to psychics and mysticism. This logical thinking on the part of the public has been the major factor responsible for the success of my books and lectures. It was early twilight when the people began gathering in New Plymouth's hall on the evening of the lecture. A minister and members of his congregation had seen a large spaceship cruise over the city. This caused much excitement, and as I arrived, people were eagerly wondering if the spaceship would return. I explained to them that I had no control over such things, and for that matter, couldn't even arrange my own contacts. If I were selfishly disposed and could arrange contacts, I would be a millionaire. Many people have offered large sums of money to me and to others to arrange contacts for them. Naturally, I have always refused such offers. Bowing to public demand, I returned to Auckland for a request lecture before leaving North Island for Christchurch in South Island. Arriving in Christchurch by plane, I was met at the airport by 9 South Island Research Group leaders. They were all splendid persons and proved to be gracious hosts. It was in this city I had the pleasure of meeting Happy Hill, a radio personality who is quite popular with the radio listeners. I had heard many favorable things about this man, and found him to be even finer than described. Hill acted as master of ceremonies for my lecture on February 10. He gave a splendid introduction, and seemed to be keenly interested in the space people. Before I left Christchurch, he took motion pictures and made sound recordings of me, to be used later by the television and radio stations for their broadcasts. In Tamaru, my next stop, we had the assistance of a government man and the use of such equipment as a screen and projector, and an operator to run the film. I also made a tape recording to be broadcast on the local radio station after my departure from New Zealand. Next I travelled south, down the coast to Dunedin, where my lecture was delivered in His Majesty's Theatre on Sunday, February 15. This completed my tour of New Zealand, and I returned to Auckland to board a plane for Australia. The success of my lecture tour in New Zealand was tremendous and the cooperation was excellent. New Zealand's population of 2.5 million people seemed open-minded and hungry for new adventures in life. If I were a young man, choosing a new land in which to live, I believe I would select New Zealand. The country offers many opportunities and the people are friendly and kind. As in later chapters, I am unable to relate fully the scenic beauties of each nation I visited. I also am not able to introduce and do justice to the many friends whom I met along the way, friends who spared themselves no effort in considering my welfare. To do so, naming each individual and describing the warmth with which I was received in their homes and families, would enlarge this report into several volumes. I sincerely hope that it will suffice for me to say that in every nation I visited during the tour, I found wonderful men and women who are dedicated to seeking out the peaceful, productive means by which we shall earn our rightful, dignified position among the civilizations of other planets. Their kindness and hospitality will never be forgotten. 2. Australia. As my plane came in for landing at Sydney, I felt an apprehension that seemed to foretell unpleasant events. I knew the opposition would not sit still when they learned that people were hungry for the truth, that hundreds were being turned away at each lecture. As it happened, the Australian press was surprised by the response I had received in New Zealand, and the lectures were well publicized by the majority of Australian newspapers. This, plus the fact that I had repeatedly exposed the fallacies of mysticism and psychic phenomena as far as the spaceships and contacts were concerned, was a major challenge to the Silence Group. They seemed determined to stop my lectures in Australia. People who follow the flying saucer investigations are becoming aware of a curious pattern, or is it really so curious? Wherever I go, whenever I lecture, someone always tries, unsuccessfully, to disclaim my contacts or to link me with the mystic hucksters. Other contact claimants are as a rule seldom, if ever, attacked by the press. The major concentrated effort has been directed against me and my evidence. Some flying saucer publications have published distorted or false reports of me, with no basis in fact. Many groups sit around Ouija boards or hold hands in a seance, and unwittingly serve the Silence Group. These and similar thoughts I threw my mind as the plane taxied to a stop at the passenger ramp. I wondered how the opposition was going to deal with the problem I had thrust upon them. My questions were answered in a matter of hours. I was met by Gordon Jameson and Roy Russell from Brisbane, and directed through customs. As I left the customs office, a group of people converged upon me. They were space enthusiasts, UFO study group leaders, and reporters. When introductions were completed, I learned a press conference had been arranged. The reporters asked many questions and later wrote articles concerning my visit to their country. Some of the reporters distorted my statements and wrote that I claimed to have visited Venus and Mars. Actually, I have never made such statements. When the press conference concluded, I inquired as to where I should stay. This was when I received the first indication that my own wishes were not being considered. My secretary had explicitly requested that I be accommodated in hotels and not in private homes. This request was completely ignored. I was given a choice of two accommodations, one with a doctor who lived far from the city, the other in an apartment building. I chose the apartment, and did not know at the time how far it was from the heart of the city. It turned out later that my only choice would have been the apartment. My hostess was an astrologer. She was endeavoring to associate astrology with the space people and their craft. I explained to her that no connection existed between the two, but she refused to accept the logical facts.